Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced by CKUT on traditional Mohawk territory in Montreal. I'm your host, Avi Gross-Grand. In this edition...
Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime!
Well, we have a plan in place, and we've made that clear from the beginning.
But first, here are the headlines. On Saturday, March 8th, International Women's Day, Mohawks in the Thayendanegea Reserve in southern Ontario blocked the CN rail line for several hours as they continued to call for a national inquiry into the missing and murdered Indigenous women. Graham Juno from CFRC Kingston's Alternative Frequency brings us our first headline.
Activist Sean Brandt and dozens of protesters from Thayendanegea have initiated direct action to force the federal government to call a national inquiry into the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Brandt and about 75 other protesters started putting up a blockade on Shannonville Road on Thayendanegea territory just outside of Belleville, Ontario, after 8 p.m. on Sunday, March the 2nd. Since then, the road has remained closed to traffic as the morning commute saw a strong Ontario Provincial Police presence after a dozen protesters spent the night and remained in the area. The OPP have even confirmed the use of drone aircraft to conduct surveillance of the protests. Sean Brandt spoke to reporters at the scene of the blockade.
Well, we have a plan in place, and we've made that clear from the beginning. Certainly we don't see failure as being an option. We want to take whatever steps that we feel are necessary in order to compel the government to move forward. We're appealing to other First Nations communities across this country to do the same thing and to understand that if we can't compel this government to take action on 825 dead First Nations women and girls, then we reasonably can't make any request to this government. We can't deal with education, we can't deal with housing. If we can't bring this to a resolution and have them take some meaningful action by way of a national action strategy and a national inquiry into something so obviously criminal and disgusting, then we can't expect any justice or recourse on any issue, and we want people to stand for this.
Catherine Fisher brings us our next headline from CJLY, Nelson, British Columbia, about recent arrests at the Sinixt Cultural Camp on Perry Ridge. Thank you to Greg Nesterdorf for the files.
On Tuesday, March 2nd, two people were arrested at the Sinixt Slocan Perry Ridge Cultural Camp in the Slocan Valley in British Columbia. Sinixt spokesperson Marilyn James and Sinixt media liaison Dennis Sorelli were arrested after refusing to comply with a court injunction granted to Galena Contractors of Nicusp, B.C. Galena received a contract from B.C. Timber Sales permitting them to extend a forest service road at Perry Ridge and harvest 5,000 cubic meters of wood. In the summer of 2013, Sinixt Nation initiated the Sinixt Slocan Perry Ridge Cultural Camp on their ancestral lands in southeastern BC. Perry Ridge is culturally significant to the Sinixt people because it is one of the last intact alpine wetlands within the Slocan Valley, which for thousands of years was used and is still used by the Sinixt in continuation of their cultural practices. Reporter Greg Nesterov spoke with Marilyn James in front of the Nelson, B.C. courthouse the day the injunction was extended. James stated that she would go back to the camp the following day, even though she was aware she'd likely be arrested.
We're actually standing in a very lawful place. I'm a Sinixt woman within Sinixt territory, acting upon my responsibilities within Sinixt society. And as a Sinixt person, I have to uphold what I am told to do and what are my responsibilities to my society.
James said she would stand on the logging road to protect Sinixt cultural laws and practices in spite of the risk.
I breathe culture. I inhale it, I exhale it. I live it. That's why it's important. If I couldn't practice my culture, I would cease being a human being.
Marilyn James and Dennis Cirelli are expected back in court to answer to charges of contempt on March 17th. Stay tuned for an update on Groundwire.
Amelie Philipson from CKUT Montreal brings us the next headline about the new homelessness policy in Quebec.
On Thursday, February 27th, Quebec Minister Véronique Yvon announced a national policy for homelessness. This policy makes homelessness a national priority and pushes the government to act. It identifies not only the individual causes, but also the structural causes of homelessness who must be addressed in order to prevent homelessness by reducing exclusion. The National Policy for Homelessness recognizes the diversity of profiles of homeless people, which is an important tool to formulate adequate solutions. It also recognizes that the fight against homelessness requires a continuous effort. This is necessary for the policy to be coherent and sustainable, not only in terms of health support and social services, but also in terms of education, social inclusion, professional inclusion, legislation, and housing. The National Solidarity Network for Homelessness considers that this policy is satisfying but doesn't sufficiently take into account regional homelessness.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Ontem sonhei que eu fui em um lugar onde eu nunca fui.
Fui.
Sem carro, telefone, celular, nada que polui.
Lui.
Sem fome, sem polícia militar.
Mon agite pour ses familles. Sans isani, pas de problème, nous voulons repartir. Pas bon ici, tout le monde tranquille, nous pas nous mentir. Nous contenter de s'engager, nous pas nous plaindre. Qui tive raison, à tolérance, respect, à patience. Pour ce monde, dans ce monde, nous n'avons pas d'indifférence. Mon grand dans sa monde, dans l'ouest, tout le monde, c'est croyance. Sans qu'il tienne, c'est racine, prends fierté dans le pays. Pas grand qu'il faut du chimique, avant, nous pas qu'à détruire. Ni pour ni chevin, n'accepter nati, nous. Réconcilier avec la fixe, c'est là pour une jeune histoire.
Sem fome, sem polícia militar para reprimir.
Oh, 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 oh. Te dá son pé, mango, manja, gogo. Mas canta la zombie a fete na la copa que empieça em justiça hospital.
You just heard Fui by Vox Sambu. Now it's time for our feature stories. In February, migrant justice organizers in Hamilton, Ontario, won a significant victory when their city council voted unanimously to declare Hamilton to be Canada's second sanctuary city. Scott Nye of Talking Radical Radio reports from Sudbury, Ontario.
According to Hamilton, Ontario-based migrant justice organizer Caitlin Craven, more and more people who have built lives for themselves in Canada are being pushed by the immigration system into situations of precarious legal status or even into being completely undocumented.
The government is curtailing the access people have to more permanent types of visas and more permanent types of residency and actually expanding temporary access. And so we're seeing a lot more people in Canada being placed in this precarious temporary status situation that makes them very vulnerable to losing their status effectively and then not being able to do things like access the services that they need or, you know, apply for the permanent residency that they may or may not want.
To address the danger to undocumented people in accessing the services that they and their families need, organizers in the United States have for decades taken the approach of pushing city governments to declare themselves sanctuary cities. Organizer José Oliphant explains.
The sanctuary city allows all residents, regardless of their immigration status, to access city services without having to fear being reported to federal authorities.
Toronto was the first Canadian city to take this step, and it was news of that victory in early 2013 that inspired people from social service agencies, unions, community groups, and activist formations to come together in Hamilton, a city of 500,000 people on the west end of Lake Ontario. In their year of doing public education, gathering endorsements, and building support, this coalition had to face more than a little hostility and resistance, most of which focused on questions of illegality and that people should, quote, wait their turn to get into the country, and on concerns about cost to taxpayers. Craven and Oliphant talk about how they challenge some of these myths.
One of the important things we tried to bring out was the way in which, quote unquote, waiting your turn is not really an option in the way that the immigration system has radically changed in Canada in the past few years.
And then in terms of the tax dollars arguments for the city of Hamilton, their report concluded that it would cost them no funding.
One of the other things that we tried to promote as a way to break this myth that somehow having access without fear is a drain on city service budget is to recognize that what we're really talking about are people who live and work here, right? And if you live and work here, you are contributing in numerous ways to the city as members of the community, but also as taxpayers and as people who rent and as people who work and potentially employ your own workers in the community.
With the help of a supportive city councillor, a motion to declare Hamilton a sanctuary city reached first a committee and then full council in February 2014. Craven talks about how they mobilized to ensure the motion passed.
Over the course of doing presentations and outreach and stuff, we collected a group of supporters, so emails of supporters, and we used this to reach out and get folks in different wards. So we had everybody kind of listed by the ward that they were in and then did outreach to get people in different wards. To phone their counselors, we had a draft email that they could send in, and we strongly encouraged them to show up the day of the vote. So we had a large group of people there on both days of the vote, and we wore yellow armbands to show that we were all there together and supporting the initiative.
In the end, the vote was unanimous. It committed the city of Hamilton to a number of different things.
So first off, access without fear. So accessing all city services and not being questioned about your status as an immigrant. And also that city service workers will not have to inform Immigration Canada if you are undocumented. They also committed to having someone go out and do these presentations so that the community knows that they can now access municipal services and that they shouldn't have to fear them. And they also committed to lobbying the government provincially and federally to protect residents of the city.
While organizers see this as an important victory, they also recognize that it is just one step in a larger vision for migrant justice.
What folks in Toronto are finding is that a lot of the promises of making services accessible don't actually come to fruition. So I think there's a lot of work to do to keep on the city to make sure that they're actually enforcing what they have committed to. And then there's the context of working with folks from Toronto and from other cities to push the momentum in other cities. As more coalitions of people are able to form to put pressure on their cities to adopt sanctuary city policies, then that can mobilize itself into putting the ball in the province's court to say, well, all of these cities are saying that access to services is important and that fear is causing harm to residents of our cities and our province. So now it's the provincial government's turn to take a stand and reshape access in this province. The discrimination on the basis of status is not what determines whether or not you get access to healthcare or to education.
For Groundwire, this is Scott Nye reporting for Talking Radical Radio in Sudbury, Ontario.
The Handy Dart Riders Alliance in British Columbia is calling for improved transit access and funding for people with disabilities and elderly people. Megan Thomas of CJSF Burnaby brings us this feature story.
A newly formed Handy Dart Riders Alliance, open to Handy Dart Riders and their allies, has been formed in Vancouver, BC, and held their first public meeting and elected board members on Saturday, March 1st, 2014. The meeting was attended by Linda McGowan, Consumer Advocacy Manager for MVT Canadian Bus Incorporated, which oversees Handy Dart services, and George Heyman, MLA for Vancouver Fairview, and the NDP Transportation Critic. Handy Dart is a door-to-door transit service for people with disabilities and older seniors who cannot use the regular transit system for at least some trips. The alliance was formed after data was obtained through Freedom of Information requests, showing that people with disabilities and seniors were denied Handy Dart service over 42,000 times in 2013, which represents an eightfold increase in 4 years. The Handy Dart Riders Alliance voted to engage with a public campaign to ask that when the referendum on transportation is put to the public, it will include an item to improve special transportation. Groundwire spoke with Handy Dart Riders Committee spokesperson and former Vancouver City Councillor Tim Lewis. I reached Tim via phone at his Vancouver offices.
Seniors are prisoners in their own homes because when they call to get a ride, they are unable to do so. The Handy Dart Riders Alliance recognizes that no Handy Dart system is perfect and that demand will always be higher than supply. But the problem is this. The number of trip turnarounds is skyrocketing, and it means that when an individual dependent on Handy Dart phones to book a trip to apply for work, to go to work, to attend a medical appointment, to go on a social outing, they're unable to get the ride and remain prisoners in their own home for the rest of that day. And what it indicates is a complete lack of commitment to making the overall transit system accessible.
Tim Lewis was one of the organizers in 1981 who created Handy Dart and founded the first operator co-op in order to deliver its services. Groundwire also spoke with Elsie Dean, retired public school teacher, seniors advocate, and member of the Handy Dart Riders Alliance. We spoke at her home in North Burnaby.
The Advisory Council for the Disabled to the City of Vancouver have recommended that there be 50% Handy Dart buses and 50% taxis. Taxi service has been used for a whole year already. The severely handicapped and the mentally challenged are finding it really bad because they get let off at wrong places. They're not taken to the door, although some of them can hardly maneuver. The reason the Handy Dart Advisory Committee proposed 50% of each, the Handy Dart and the taxi, was because they are told by TransLink that if they use more taxis, it will increase the rides because they're cheaper. They think if we get 50% use of taxis, they'll get 50% more rides. Research done by Eric Doherty, who's a professional in transportation, he questions that because he said their method of coming to that conclusion is flawed. They've calculated, they've thrown both systems into a pot, and they're not looking at the distances and doing the fine calculations.
I asked both Tim and Elsie what success would look like for the Handy Dart Riders Alliance in regards to this referendum.
If there's a referendum, that would be one of the things listed on the referendum that needs to be improved and that people agree, I suppose, to pay more money, whatever way they pay it, to provide transportation for people who cannot ride the regular transit system and have no other way of getting around.
Success is increasing the service level to the point that trip turndowns get reduced back to what they historically were 5 and 10 years ago.
It's the responsibility of the public first to recognize that there's this need and it is a right of these people to have transportation.
The provincial government has delayed transit improvements, including Handy Dart service increases, pending a transit funding referendum likely to be held in June 2015. BC Transit Minister Todd Stone has given mayors until June 30th to table a transit vision, which, if they comply, would see a referendum happen no later than June of 2015. If mayors miss this deadline, Stone says the transit funding vote will be pushed off until November of 2017, with TransLink relying on existing funding sources to operate until then. For Groundwire, this is Megan Thomas reporting for CJSF Radio from SFU Burnaby Mountain.
We now turn to press freedoms in Egypt, as people around the world continue to push for the release of four Al Jazeera journalists who were arrested in Cairo on serious charges of collaboration with the Muslim Brotherhood. CKUT's Amelie Philipson brings us more from Montreal.
Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime! Journalism not a crime!
Al Jazeera organized a global day of action in support of their four reporters who are detained in Cairo. Yet Belgraver from the Al Jazeera English office in Toronto spoke about it to CKUT.
There were events, more than 30 of them, a variety of events, both vigils, protests, speaking engagements, and events in front of various Egyptian embassies. I mean, we had events that included Jakarta, Kuala Lumpur, Seoul, Islamabad, Abuja, Johannesburg, Nairobi, Sana'a, Ramallah, Beirut, in Washington, in New York.
Peter Gresty, Mohamed Fahmy, and Baher Mohamed are accused of having ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, who is considered a terrorist organization by the current Egyptian government. Sherif Fahmy, the brother of Mohamed Fahmy, corresponded with CKUT via email. He wrote, I quote, "Mohamed is being accused of being a member of a terrorist group and serving their interest by manipulating and tampering with news materials."
These charges are nonsense. We are a credible international news organization, and I think if the Egyptian government isn't comfortable with the fact that we speak to all sides and that we report the facts as they are, that's a problem they have. Journalism is not a crime. One of the critiques or one of the reasons that they threw our journalists in jail is the lack of accreditation. Now, this is an administration issue. You do not throw journalists in jail for not having the right credentials.
Sherif Fahmy, the brother of Al Jazeera reporter Mohamed Fahmy, wrote, I quote, "If they took the time to look into the history of the family, they would have realized that we are an extremely patriotic family and we have nothing to do with the Muslim Brotherhood ideology. Both my grandparents were in the Egyptian police force and we were all brought up in Canada enjoying the democratic freedom. My brother, Mohamed, is an extremely objective journalist who's passionate towards his profession and has taken pride in his work throughout his career." Not only are the charges against the journalists stepping over the boundaries of press freedom, but as Ihab Lotayef explains, they are based on the wrong assumption of the Muslim Brotherhood being a terrorist organization.
The claim itself that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization is not substantiated in any way, even in the documents of the Egyptian government itself that announced them as a terrorist organization.
The current justice system in Egypt is used in a way that goes against the rights of the detainees, which could make it difficult to prove the innocence of the Al Jazeera journalists.
The mere fact of the extension of the detention of those journalists and the acceptance of the prosecution and the court to indefinitely extend their detention the way it's happening is a proof that nobody's interested in justice, really.
However, Sherif Fahmy, who is in contact with his brother Mohamed in prison, wrote, I quote, "We believe that Mohamed's situation is extremely strong in this case. He joined Al Jazeera English in Cairo on the 7th of September and he was still in his probation period when he got arrested. There wasn't any official contract between Al Jazeera and Mohamed, which proves that he was still being treated as a freelance. We are sure that once the Egyptian authorities start viewing what was recorded in the cameras that were confiscated, it will prove Mohamed's innocence. Once again, we stand strong in this case and all the documents proving Mohamed's innocence are now with the Egyptian authorities."
The reports that came out about their conditions of detention are quite appalling, actually. There is physical violence, there is attacks, there is inhuman living or jail conditions.
Sherif Fahmy wrote about the detention conditions of his brother Mohamed and their effects on his health. I quote, "He has suffered the harshest conditions of the maximum security solitary confinement prison for over a month and was then moved to his current prison, Al Mulhaq. They have unfairly charged him as belonging to the Muslim Brotherhood, and he finds himself grouped with high-profile Muslim Brotherhood and Salafi jihadist members in prison. The humerus bone in his right shoulder remains badly fractured. Mohamed feels that the authorities leaving his arm without proper treatment is a kind of torture. He is currently being detained with Peter and Baher. They are being handcuffed to each other all the time, even while using the bathroom or during praying. Since Mohamed got transferred to Al Mulhaq prison, we are able to visit him regularly. The last visit was yesterday, 1st of March 2014. He looked strong and very confident. Mohamed is once again calling for strong action from the Canadian government, not only the embassy in Cairo."
Now it's time for our community radio report. In this week's community radio report, CKUT's Aaron Lakoff looks at AMARC's International Women's Day special programming.
March 8th marks International Women's Day each year, and this year, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, or AMARC, celebrated the occasion with its 10th annual Women's Day campaign. The Women's International Network of AMARC organized the campaign under the theme Equality in Speech and brought together programming and podcasts in several languages from different continents. AMARC says it believes that women can be active agents of change when they can access the airwaves themselves. The organization also says they should take on leadership roles in leading their countries and communities towards long-term development and democratization. AMARC hopes that this multilingual broadcast campaign will substantively contribute to the discussion on these issues and in identifying practical as well as long-term solutions. Here is a short collage of programs from the AMARC International Women's Day campaign.
Azure FM, émission spéciale.
Bonjour, nous sommes élèves au lycée agricole d'Erstein et nous avons décidé de travailler sur la journée de la femme. Nous avons traité plusieurs thèmes pour en savoir plus sur l'égalité entre les hommes et les femmes dans la société française. Malgré l'existence d'une journée de la femme, pourquoi est-elle autant exploitée par les médias ?
Femme Talk 89 FM, from peace in the home to peace in the world.
A girl is in hospital with a coma. The doctor has called her mother to come in and sit with her.
Mrs. Debbie, I'm Dr. Diasa. Please sit down.
La Red de Mujeres de AMARC presenta. Disminuyendo la violencia. Experiencias exitosas de aplicación en el trabajo directo con las mujeres.
सामुदायिक रेडियो रेडियो मकवानपुर 101.3 मेगाहर्जले आफ्नो तेस्रो वार्षिक उत्सवको अवसरमा विविध कार्यक्रम सम्पन्न गरेको छ. यसै अनुरूप
L'équipe de la radio 3R Rockab en Tunisie présente
Plus forte que la violence.
Une émission contre la violence à l'égard des femmes.
La violence contre la femme est un phénomène social très répandu. Elle ne se limite pas dans une catégorie particulière. La femme peut être victime de la violence d'un père impitoyable, un mari injuste ou violent.
For more information on AMARC's International Women's Day campaign, you can visit www.amarc.org/march8-2014. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
You just heard La Rata by Lido Pimienta. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by CKUT. Music this week was by Vox Sambu and Lido Pimienta. Headlines this week were written by Graham Juno, Emily Phillipson, and Catherine Fisher. We also thank Scott Nye, Aaron Lakoff, Megan Thomas, and Greg Nesterdorf. I've been your host, Avi Grossgrand. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.